Medicare defines how death is regulated and managed in the United States. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn and for Kate Archer Kent. And that is the jumping off point for the article co-authored in part by our next guests and published this month in the journal Health Affairs. They write that the reason so many Americans spend the end of their lives in medical settings like hospitals and nursing homes is because that cost can be shared, while the cost of dying at home or in some hospice falls overwhelmingly on family and loved ones. So if you have a story to share this hour, please join us, 1-800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. What would you like to know about hospice care and compassionate end-of-life care? Our guest this morning, Alexis Drutches, an instructor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and palliative care physician at Massachusetts General Hospital. Dr. Drutches, good morning and welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi there. I'm so glad to be here. Thanks for having us.
Also joining us, Dr. Amy Bachman, attending physician and case management advisor at Massachusetts General Hospital. Dr. Bachman, good morning.
Good morning.
And Alexis, I'll start with you. As you and Amy say in Health Affairs, that it is time for us to reconsider our values when it comes to end-of-life care. And you're talking big picture here. How do you set up the issue or the problem?
I think the problem overall is multifold and, of course, enormous for us to tackle today. But I think in general, in especially westernized American healthcare, we really value more treatment-focused care and sort of aggressive interventional care. And of course, that's allowed people to live longer with critical chronic illness. But at the same time, I think the other end of the coin there, the other side of the coin, is that it really devalues comfort-focused care and spending for comfort-focused care for those who want to have their end of life in the home.
Yeah, and Dr. Bachman, how do you see the problem and the assessment that, you know, reconsidering our values may be just bigger than our family values?
Very similarly, I think it's a real tragedy that as people are entering the end of life, we suddenly change. You know, I think what the hospice benefit does is it changes the reimbursement, and so that we actually place less value at the end of life in terms of what we're able to support in the home. And that's what really drove us to write this.
Mm-hmm. And when considering hospice care, Dr. Bachman, why would somebody consider delaying hospice care in this end of life compassionate treatment?
That's a great question. And a big part of that relates to what the hospice benefit provides. So how it's structured, the daily reimbursement rate is about $203 per day. And that really limits the amount of care that can be provided in the home in terms of nurse check-ins and home health aid support. And this really averages out to about 3 to 5 hours a week in the home. And the reality is that when people are dying or at the end of life, they often need a lot more than 3 to 5 hours of help in the week. And so what that means is that instead of transitioning to hospice care, they may choose to stay under their Medicare A benefit, which provides hospital level care and skilled nursing level care. And they'll defer that decision to transition towards hospice.
Yeah, let's go to Rona and Cameron this morning. Rona, you're on the air with Dr. Bachman and Dr. Drutches. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, doctors. And my name is Rana, not Rona.
Oh, sorry, Rana. Thank you.
I'm calling because this situation is very near and dear to my heart. My dad was given the option by his wife to either go to the nursing home or move in with myself. And so my dad moved in with us as he had a dreaded fear of care facilities. So he came into our home for 3 years with Parkinson's and Lewy body dementia. The only way we made it was with fabulous caretakers, as in those situations you need 24-hour care, which I took the evening shift. Towards the end, we had great hospice help, but in the three years Dad lived with us, trying to navigate the Medicare, the Social Security, trying to learn what other services are out there to protect my father's funds from, I hate to say it, his wife, who was also starting to suffer with some issues, was a whole nother lesson in itself. And my call this morning is to urge people to be proactive in trying to determine and find some of those resources before you get put into that situation. It's difficult enough to care for a loved one 24 hours a day and work full time, let alone try to figure out how you're going to manage their funds to make them last so they can stay in their home and you can fulfill the wants and needs of your loved one. I'd do it again for my father without any question, but it is not easy, but it was rewarding, and thank you.
Rana, thank you for sharing your story. Dr. Drutges, does this sound familiar and similar?
Yeah, I first wanted to say, Ron, I'm so sorry that you had gone through that with your family. You're certainly not alone. And I think your story hits on quite a few critical points that my co-authors and I really wanted to touch upon, which it's a big misconception that hospice will cover 24-hour in-home care. And as individuals get sicker, people need more care with day-to-day functions like getting out of bed, getting to the toilet, cooking. A lot of that, almost all of it, is on family caregivers. And research has really shown that, 61% of family caregivers also work out of the home, and 69% of hospice caregivers are women. So there's an incredible burden on family caregivers to provide 24-hour support. They're all struggling, working, potentially children of their own. And at the same time, dealing with the emotional and psychological burden really of caring for families, loved ones who are dying in the home. That in and of itself takes a great deal of emotional energy on top of everything else. So Rana, you certainly aren't alone, and you hit on some of the critical issues that we're hoping to make sure people know about as they look ahead.
Dr. Alexis Drutges is an instructor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and a palliative care physician at Massachusetts General. Also joining us, Dr. Amy Bachman, attending physician and case management advisor at Massachusetts General, and you as well at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Building on what Rana had said and advising us to plan ahead, I would ask Dr. Bachman, how would I even go about that as I have aging loved ones? Where would I begin to look at how I could start navigating the Medicare, Medicaid now?
It's a great question. I think one of the first things to do is to think about what resources you have available, who in the family can help, what friends can help, and how, if the goal is to go home, How can we make that possible, either by working together as a family or potentially bringing in additional help? And then also working with the hospice agency to find out what the maximum benefits can be that can be put into the home. And then really it just comes down to, thinking about whether this is possible. It's honestly not possible for a lot of families, and that's okay. And so I think it can place a lot of stress and burden and hardship on families to try to take somebody into the home. And it's something that, I think as Rana mentioned, it takes a lot of planning and thought, and that, the best way to plan is to just have really open conversations as early as possible to give yourself as much lead time to try to get those resources in the home.
Yeah, our guest this morning, Dr. Amy Bachman, attending physician and case management advisor at Massachusetts General Hospital, Dr. Alexis Drutges, an instructor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and a palliative care physician at Massachusetts General, and you as well with your stories at 1-800-642-1234 about compassionate care, about end-of-life care that is caring. And the discrepancy there, not just in not family values, it's about institutional values. It's about the way our systems are set up and whether or not we redirect them that in a way that reflects our values. It seems to be the bigger picture here of the article co-authored by our guests and our experiences shared. So what do you have to impart at 1-800-642-1234? We'll continue this conversation throughout the hour. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Dying at home should not just be a luxury for those who have enough family close by or for those affluent enough to pay. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and that's the case our guests made in the healthcare journal Health Affairs earlier this month. And they add, the burdens of personal caregiving end up largely falling on women and people in marginalized communities. So how can we improve our quality of life all the way to the end in a systemic way that can help us all? take your calls this morning at 1-800-642-1234. Our guests, the co-authors of the article, Alexis Drutches, an instructor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, palliative care physician at Massachusetts General Hospital, and a UW-Madison alum, where, by the way, it is snowing heavily this morning, Dr. Drutches. Also joining us this morning, Dr. Amy Bachman, an attending physician and case management advisor at Massachusetts General Hospital. And if we were starting to look at solutions, what would be the lowest hanging fruit, Dr. Drutches?
I think that is a really tough one, because in many ways, I think we all need to consider the fact that we're all going to be facing this, either for ourselves or our loved ones. And we really need to advocate for change on a larger level in terms of CMS spending, which is what Dr. Bachman talked about earlier. You know, the daily rate is capped at $203, and that's just not enough to provide the type of care that individuals need to remain comfortable and decrease suffering in the home, as compared to the fact that we will spend exorbitant amounts for aggressive inpatient level of care. So I think in many ways, as more and more of us think about how to get involved with our local government, I think we need to think about how our elected representatives also help to guide these policies and where spending is. So I think in many ways, you know, there might be lower hanging fruit, but I think we also need to think a bit bigger.
Stephen Madison wrote to ask, at what level of the political process are these reimbursement rates determined? And so who, where to go in terms of beginning this solution in a systemic way, Dr. Bachman?
So, you know, this funding is determined by CMS. So we really have to advocate, as Alexis mentioned, at the highest level. And I would encourage you all, you know, I think the patient stories are just so powerful. I think hearing from Rana earlier this morning, it's just, it's so much more powerful than even for us to come and present data and, you know, share policy expertise. It's just not as powerful as, you know, bringing the stories straight to the legislators to really push to increase this funding.
Yeah, and Amy, you primarily work with patients in hospital. What are patients experiencing?
I would say Rana's story is very similar. We see this all the time. It's really painful for families where they come into the hospital, their patients, and they're ready to make the transition. They want to go home. They want to be comfortable, but they're not able to get the resources to make that possible. And they end up, you know, choosing instead to continue the cycle of, you know, inpatient hospitalizations and SNF and, you know, to go to a skilled nursing facility because they're just not able to support going home. I think it's very painful for patients. And I think hearing these stories is one of the best paths forward because, like I said, we have lots of data to show this, but it's very hard. It's hard to really make that a priority without the power of the stories.
Yeah, the experience will trump the data every time. CMS, by the way, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and your stories are welcome here at 1-800-642-1234 throughout the hour with our guests, Alexis Drutches, an instructor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, palliative care physician at Massachusetts General, and Amy Bachman, attending physician and case management advisor at Massachusetts General Hospital. They wrote the article in Health Affairs about how Medicaid in many ways dictates our end-of-life care and what we could do to change that. And I do want to ask, and I don't know who's best to answer this here, about hospice care and hospice agencies and how we differentiate between the two and how we differentiate between different hospice agencies and what we should be aware of. I guess, Dr. Drutches, you want to, is that the...
Yeah, okay. I'm happy to take the first pass at it and then hand it over to Dr. Bachman
Thank
as
you.
Well. So in terms of hospice care and hospice agencies, there are minimum requirements for what hospice care provides because it's care that's really focused on quality of life by increasing comfort and decreasing suffering and thinking about the whole person. So all hospice agencies have to provide, social workers, chaplains, medical visits that are in line with the needs of the patient. But as we talk about in the article, there are not-for-profit and for-profit agencies. And so I think what we really need is increased transparency regarding what agencies provide what amount of care. Right now, Medicare.gov has a compare website where you can see various agencies. And I think that's one place to think about is we need more transparency. The other issue here is some of it comes down to your insurance and where you live geographically. So I know, you know, in the greater Boston area, there are certain hospice agencies that cover certain cities and towns in and around Boston. And that also is a part of this. You know, if there's a great hospice agency a couple hours away, right, they're not going to be able to help you in the way that you need in the home. I think the other part is there are some innovations with certain hospices that Dr. Bachman may be able to speak to more as well. But when we think about comfort-focused care, we usually have to give up any interventional type care, even smaller things like fluids or dialysis or certain chemotherapies that might be palliative. And so that really makes people choose between focusing solely on what's determined to be comfort focus versus interventional type care. And some hospice agencies are creating new models of care to think about how to continue some of those services that focus on comfort for a short amount of time, such as continuing dialysis while you're on hospice. And I think these are really important models to think about in our payment structures, to allow our patients to stay at home, but not have to fully give up on care that might prolong life and increase their comfort. So thinking about what agencies might be offering that and advocating for
Dr. Bachman,
like that, I think is important.
Oh, I'm sorry, I cut you off.
Please, Dr. Bachman, go ahead.
I would just add that I think this idea of increasing transparency would be really helpful. There's probably a lot of variation between what the different agencies are providing. You know, 2/3 of hospice agencies are now for-profit entities. And while many for-profit agencies, you know, I'm sure provide outstanding care, there are different incentives. And so I think making it possible for consumers to actually see what amount of care is provided with the different agencies would be really helpful.
Dr. Bachman, you're a case management advisor at Massachusetts General. And, you know, I hear stories of nurse navigators when it comes time to certain treatments and cancers and dealing with the whole person as opposed to the cancer diagnosis. What about the idea of navigators for end-of-life care?
I think that's a wonderful solution. This is oftentimes a very stressful period in people's lives. They're dealing with illness, they're dealing with many other stressors, and then to have to navigate these really complicated benefits is very, very difficult. I think, you know, a lot of at our hospital, we have a representative from an agency that we partner with that helps navigate patients and provides information about this. But I think making that more of a standardized process so that patients are given uniformly the same information and can make that decision for themselves would be really helpful.
The siren you hear is over the radio, by the way. Just wanted to make that clear. That is Dr. Amy Bachman, an attending physician and case management advisor at Massachusetts General Hospital. Also joining us, Dr. Alexis Drutches, instructor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and a palliative care physician at Massachusetts General. Your calls at 1-800-642-1234 as we continue this conversation throughout the hour. It started with the article that our guest wrote in Health Affairs earlier this month, explaining why the discrepancy here between the system and our value. And our family when it comes to the values of end-of-life care. So, and I'd ask both of you this with the little time we have left briefly. Dr. Drutches, what are you hoping the response to your article will inevitably be?
You know, we really wanted to get the word out. As Dr. Bachman said, stories go much farther than data. And I think we all need to get involved in our local state representation and advocate for change, knowing that none of us will leave, you know, unscathed by this. So I'm really hoping that people feel empowered to think about what end-of-life care ideally looks like for them and try to get involved in the, you know, in local policies to make a change.
Dr. Bachman, what difference would you like to see your work make here?
I agree. I think encouraging people to bring their stories and advocate and to bring this to the attention of legislators.
State and federal?
I think state and federal.
Yeah, I want to thank you both for writing the article, bring it to our attention, and sharing it with us this morning. Dr. Alexis Drutches, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, it was wonderful to be here. Thank you so much.
Dr. Amy Bachman, thank you as well.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Alexis Drutches is an instructor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and a palliative care physician at Massachusetts General. Amy Bachman, attending physician and case management advisor at Massachusetts General. These are not easy conversations to have, but they are essential. So up next is the news, and then we'll speak with a leader of Wisconsin-based nonprofit hospice agency as we provide a local perspective to our end-of-life care, and we continue with your stories as well. As our guest made clear, that may be what ends up making the difference, and it's strange how these stories can be so universal, so much like the human experience, especially when we get to those times like the end-of-life care and the compassion we look for there and the comfort. We all, it's universal, right? So, our conversation continues. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you are listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn and for Kate Archer Kent. And we began this hour with a couple of doctors from Massachusetts General Hospital. They detailed the power that Medicare has in dictating how we are going to die. They explained why U.S. policies fail to currently support the desire we all have to die with some dignity and in some comfort. Now let's get a Wisconsin perspective with some local specifics and an invitation for you to share your stories about fighting for what's right for those approaching the end of their days. 1-800-642-1234 to join our conversation. Email open to you, ideas@WPR.org. Joining us now is Lynn Sexton, the president and CEO of a Grace Hospice and Palliative Care Agency in Wisconsin. Lynn, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm curious, the most common thing you hear from patients and their families after they sign up for hospice would be what?
So I have a saying that I've carried around in my back pocket and pull out every once in a while. And the most, if I had a nickel for every time I heard a family say, if we had known this is what hospice would have done for us, we would have signed up so much sooner. I'd be a wealthy woman if I had a nickel for every time I heard that comment.
Well, now, why do they say that? What's the reasoning behind the delay? And you know, and why do they ultimately think they should have started sooner?
There's all sorts of reasons that go into someone choosing to delay going on to hospice. You know, just the word hospice has scary connotations for those facing very serious illness. It can evoke feelings of, well, I'm giving up if I go on to hospice. There's no hope for me left. Or maybe their physicians aren't agreeing that hospice is the right approach. And the physicians think, no, there's one more intervention that we can do that might save you. But all too often, the result is, you know, over care, too much care, and ultimately when the family joins, they are relieved at the kind of support and the way that we can come in and provide comfort, help their loved one maybe enjoy life more than they have in more than a year because of the treatments they've been undergoing.
And we're taking your calls this morning at 1-800-642-1234, and where Valerie in Burlington is standing by. Valerie, good morning. You're on with Lynn Sexton, president and CEO of a Grace Hospice and Palliative Care in Wisconsin.
Good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call. You know, I had the pleasure of having both my parents experience hospice. And, you know, ahead of time, I think it was the best thing that was determined was what my parents wanted ahead of time, doing the research ahead of time, having the living will, the power of medical power of attorney, all of that ahead of time. So when it came for my parents for their end of life care, we knew as their children what they wanted. And what an experience we all had. from the nurses, the doctors, the chaplains, the nursing assistants.
The volunteers.
Yeah, volunteers, everybody. So it was just a wonderful experience, not just for us, but for my parents. You know, they were treated with compassion, empathy, and respect of their wishes and how they wanted their end of days to play out. So,
yeah.
And as a nurse, you know, I'm definitely going to respect my parents and my patients' wishes. And I totally want everyone to do the research ahead of time. It's going to be so much less stressful.
Valerie, thank you for sharing your family story this morning at 1-800-642-1234. And Lynn, I imagine what you hear there from Valerie is something else that you hear all too common.
Oh, always. And my guess is that Valerie and her parents did the important work of having healthcare directives in place before they got to the point where they could not articulate their wishes. It sounds like she knew ahead of time what they wanted and was able to execute that.
And it has been a central theme this morning throughout our conversation that when it comes to end-of-life care, it may be something psychologically that none of us want to cope with, but if we plan ahead, that it will be better as we approach the end for our family, for our friends, for our loved ones, and for ourselves across the board.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Lynn, we're having a little bit of a connection problem here, so let's take a brief break if we can in the conversation. Continue with your calls at 1-800-642-1234. Reconnect with our guest, Lynn Sexton, president and CEO of Agrace Hospice and Palliative Care in Wisconsin, and your stories as well. As our guest began the hour, if we're going to change this system of end-of-life care, and in a systemic way, we're going to have to do so with the personal stories that make a difference across the board. So you are welcome to share yours this hour, your families and your friends and your loved ones at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Our conversation with Lynn Sexton, president and CEO of Agrace Hospice and Palliative Care in Wisconsin, continues. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Perhaps you've noticed over this past hour, these kinds of conversations are not easy, but they are essential. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're looking at how we can improve our quality of our lives when it comes to caring for us as we approach the end of our days. There is no escaping how the ways our loved ones leave this earth become a part of the way in which we remember them, for better or for worse. So we've been speaking with palliative care experts about how to rise the tides for all boats as they approach their final shore. And there's time for your stories this morning, and they may be the ones that make a difference. You can also ask our guest your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Lynn Sexton is the president and CEO of Agrace Hospice Palliative Care in Wisconsin. And Lynn, let me ask you some specifics here, and that would have to do about what the requirements would be for people who are receiving hospice.
So in order to be eligible for hospice, Medicare has very specific guidelines. And the most important of those are that two physicians have to agree that your prognosis is for a life expectancy of 6 months or less. So that's kind of the high bar that you have to have two physicians agree to.
And what services does hospice generally provide?
So hospice is a truly interdisciplinary approach to care, where the team, the interdisciplinary team, is led by a nurse case manager. The team also has on it chaplains, grief counselors, physicians, social workers, nursing assistants, and that group of people regularly meets and discusses the needs of their patients and what type of resources need to be sent out to the home on what interval and so forth. In addition, I know I omitted volunteers. They also have volunteers at their disposal as well.
Absolutely. 1-800-642-1234 to join our conversation and share your stories. Beth and Madison joins us now. Beth, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. I want to start just by thanking you for your leadership with a Grace and all the services that a Grace provides. They have helped multiple members of my family, extended family, and friend network.
Thank you.
I'm in a situation with my mother where we are receiving palliative care from a Grace, and the some health care providers at her facility feel that she should be on full-blown hospice versus the palliative care. The palliative care nurse has been wonderful and does believe that palliative care is the right place for her. I'm wondering if you could just articulate what that transition looks like from palliative care to full-blown hospice. And I did hear the previous statement about two physicians with the six-month life expectancy. Is there any other considerations or anything you can point to about this difference of opinion between these professionals, between palliative care and a hospice diagnosis?
Beth, thank you. Lynn?
That's a great question, Beth. We get that a lot. So hopefully my answer will help all sorts of folks. Our palliative care nurses are helping patients who life expectancy is longer than 6 months, but are suffering with some sort of serious illness. They help with symptom management. They help make sure people get the resources. They might be able to direct palliative care patients to connect with our ADRCs and other types of resources. As their disease progresses, our palliative care nurses are very good at watching it when that pivot point occurs, that they're beginning to think, yeah, their disease has progressed to the point where they're probably eligible for hospice at this point. They will, in turn, communicate with our hospice physicians. We have a team of hospice physicians, and our hospice physicians will reach out to those patients, typically their primary care physician, to see if the primary care physician concurs that, yep, at this point now they are eligible for hospice.
Beth, thank you for the call. Let's go now to Gary at 1-800-642-1234. Gary, you're on the air with Lynn Sexton, President and CEO of A Grace Hospice Palliative Care in Wisconsin.
Yes, good morning. I was living in the house with my mother when she died, and I just think we need a huge cultural shift into accepting and understanding that individual people have an individual life cycle. We all do. Death is part of that life cycle. It's not necessarily totally heroic to try to deny that that's happening. The problem is, to my mind, I don't know how you bring that about since there's so much more money to be made the way we do it now.
Oh, that it comes down to money. And Gary, thank you for the call. Lynn, comes down to money from Gary's perspective.
It's a struggle because in the end, if you don't have some way to pay your staff, it's hard to go above and beyond and provide services that are so far out of the scope of what Medicare has defined as this is what hospice will provide to patients and families. You know, your previous guest had talked about that there's different types of hospices out there, and the most notable categories are for-profit and nonprofit. And sometimes there's different objectives in how those types of organizations operate, a difference between maybe the objectives of a for-profit, publicly traded hospice versus a nonprofit hospice.
And what is a Grace?
We're a nonprofit.
A Grace is a hospice palliative care in Wisconsin is a nonprofit. President and CEO Lynn Sexton, our guest, along with your stories and your questions this morning at 1-800-642-1234. And referring back to our guest that began the hour of this conversation, the co-authors of the article from this month in Health Affairs magazine, that Medicare's hospice reimbursement systems contributes to making dying at home more difficult for many who wish it. And so how do government reimbursement rates affect a Grace, Lynn?
Oh, they absolutely do. They absolutely do. The Medicare is advised by a series of organizations in Washington, D.C., and they look at all of the data from the prior year. What did hospices, what were their profit margins? How many nurses were they sending out to patients? How many hours were those nurses spending with patients? And so on and so forth. And there's this big algorithm that spits out at the end what CMS believes any kind of increase a hospice's rates should be. So we can't choose to charge someone more, Medicare tells us this is exactly what you can charge and no more and you know, no less. So we're such a conundrum of an industry. When I talk to some of my colleague CEOs in other industries, they're so incredulous that you can't set your own prices. You can't increase prices if your expenses are increasing. No, we can't. Medicare tells us exactly what we can charge.
And how does that, I would imagine then that in some way can only impact care. I mean, it has to, right?
It limits it, I would say. Mm-hmm. It very much limits it. I know a Grace, because we're nonprofit, we have an incredible foundation where people are very generous and give money to our foundation. And some of those foundation dollars help us to go above and beyond the bare minimum requirements of Medicare. And we're able to provide services that are kind of, you know, we call ourselves the gold standard. I suppose everybody probably calls their own business the gold standard. But, you know, we're able to go above and beyond what Medicare is requiring because of our foundation.
As Gary mentioned, his mother died at home. And so what are the differences between care at home and inpatient facilities?
So most people overwhelmingly want to be in the comfort of their own home as their serious illness progresses. And I would say the preponderance of the patients that we take care of year in and year out pass away in their own home, wherever they call home. But there are occasions when someone's symptoms are so out of control and so unmanageable in the home environment that a Grace has our own inpatient facilities. They look nothing like a hospital, very comfortable, home-like environment, patios off of all of the patient rooms. And we bring patients in to get their symptoms better controlled so they can be more comfortable. This can also alleviate a lot of the caregiver burden that families are experiencing as they try to care for their loved one as death approaches. So that is another option if patients' symptoms are so bad that they qualify for that level of care.
Lisa emails us ideas@WPR.org, available to you, about how room and board at hospice homes is not covered in the Medicare hospice benefit, and costs per day in the Midwest are often about $400, which prices some people out. It goes back to money again, as Lisa sees it. But what about the room and board not covered in Medicare hospice benefit, Lynn?
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. When someone elects to move their loved one into a hospice house, so it's not because their symptoms are out of control or anything like that, but they just desire to live out their days in a hospice home, Medicare will only pay for the clinical care that's provided. They will not cover the room and board, and so patients and their families end up having to cover that. What's also incredible is even Medicaid in our state, Medicaid won't cover room and board. They'll cover room and board in a nursing home, but they won't cover it if that same patient moves into a hospice house. So it is a tremendous burden on families to be able to cover those additional expenses.
Anybody ever explain the reasons for that?
That it's just not part of the benefit. You know, there's been many runs over the years at Medicare and in our own state's Medicaid program, mm-hmm. to try to get that changed and get that covered. And to date, we haven't been successful.
Our guest is the president and CEO of Grace Hospice Palliative Care in Wisconsin. Lynn Sexton joins us, and here to answer your questions and welcoming your stories as well. What questions do you have about setting up hospice services, and what financial challenges does end-of-life care cause you or your loved ones and family? 1-800-642-1234 to join us, or email, as Lisa did, ideas@WPR.org. Lynn, how can someone considering hospice contact or begin the process of signing up for the program?
Most hospices, a Grace included, have intake programs where you simply call the hospice and they will get you lined up with the right people that can begin to process you as a potential admission. They'll send someone to the home. The nurse will do an assessment of the patient to see if it looks like they're going to be eligible. That nurse thinks, yeah, what I'm seeing here, I would think they're eligible. The nurse will get on the phone with one of our hospice physicians, and they'll end up making that determination of eligibility.
And Lynn, how do families assist with end-of-life care? What role do they play as you see it from your position?
You know, they are such a lifeline in terms of caregiving as someone's disease progresses to the point where they're not able to do simple activities of daily living for themselves, you know, bathe, brush their teeth, and so forth. Family members really step in. One of the things that we like to think of ourselves as hospice providers is in the times that we can be in the home and teach those family members about end of life and what to expect and what to do, we allow them to also be the daughter, the husband, the wife, rather than just the caregiver, that they can also step into the role that they've played for all of their life with the person that's dying and not have to completely abandon the fact that, gosh, I'm her daughter, but I'm caring for her all the time. When hospice is there, they're able to continue to be the daughter and not just the caregiver.
Our previous guest had said if we were looking for solutions, that telling our stories are essential, but also contacting our elected officials and letting them know, eliminating the barriers towards compassionate and comfortable end-of-life care is a priority for each and every one of us and seems to be a universal human desire. Do you feel the same?
Oh, absolutely. Some of the roles that I have on the national level, I am a very loud voice in promoting the kinds of changes that need to happen so that end of life can be all of the things your guests have said: dignity, comfort, not too burdensome, not financially destructive. So I absolutely agree with your previous guests.
Why do you do what you do, Lynn? What is it from you? What do you see from your perspective every day that keeps you coming back?
You know, here's what I tell people, because a lot of times when people go, you work at hospice? Oh, my God, how do you even manage that? I've worked in healthcare for going on 30 years. Most of that, I worked in a healthcare system. When I made the leap to running a hospice, I have never experienced the kind of gratitude and adulation and just kind of, some of your guests have even said it as they called in, just so thankful for what hospice was able to do. That fills the people's cups who work in hospice. The people are our patients and families. They're in such crisis when they come to us and they let us into those most delicate, intimate moments and they let us help, and we do. That keeps all of us coming back day in and day out who work in hospice.
Lynn, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Sure thing.
Lynn Sexton, president and CEO of Agrace Hospice and Palliative Care in Wisconsin. Full disclosure, Agrace is one of Wisconsin Public Radio's many business sponsors. Stay tuned for Jen White and 1A next. Today, millions remain in limbo about the future of their student debt. And although the president's budget runs to more than 100 pages, there's no mention of student loan forgiveness anywhere. So 1A finds out what hope and help there might be for those struggling to put their student debt behind them once and for all. Stay tuned. That's next here on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show.